Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. I am Dan Lush, joined as always by Dan Wallach. Dan, we have a very busy slate today. I tried to identify four stories. We do have a special guest with us. You might know him on Twitter as Old Takes Exposed, aka Freezing Cold Takes, Fred Siegel. But what you didn't know is that Fred Siegel is actually a lawyer. So we'll have Fred join us. But before we get into Fred and his path from lawyer into social media lawyer extraordinaire, we'll say, Dan, we have some big news on the Deshaun Watson front. So we'll talk Deshaun Watson. We'll talk the update in the Rams case. We're going to talk Chicago Blackhawks investigation. And I do think, Dan, if we have time, we should hit the Cleveland Guardian story. Let us take this time to remind the audience our podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. They make your success their number one priority. As we cover the intersections of sports and law, Themis covers the intersections of law students and prepping for the bar. They are the top bar review prep company in the entire world. So make sure to visit themisbar.com/condetrimental. Dan, I'll turn it to you first. We have a trade deadline approaching, Dan, November 2nd. What are you hearing on the Deshaun Watson front?
Well, I mean, John McClain from the Houston Chronicle is reporting that the Miami Dolphins and the Texans have a deal in place with two caveats, which basically mean that the deal will never happen. I think the deal will involve the sending over of three number one draft picks and maybe some second round picks, but it has two conditions precedent, according to John McClain. Number one, that Deshaun Watson resolves all 22 of his civil lawsuits. And number two, that they receive clarity from the NFL commissioner's office on whether Deshaun Watson will be placed on the NFL exempt list. That's like telling the public that a deal is not going to occur at all. There's no way that between now and the trade deadline, Deshaun Watson's going to settle 22 cases unless there's a deal already in place. And given Commissioner Goodell's evasive and cagey comments about not having enough necessary information, this thing is like this sword of Damocles hanging over Deshaun Watson interminably. It's been 7 months into an investigation and the league still can't make a decision on the NFL commissioner's exempt list. What do you think about this sort of this, you know, long, you know, fuse on the decision-making process?
Yeah, a couple things. So I saw people yelling at John McClain and yelling at other people. You reported a trade and you got my hopes up. There's been no trade that's been reported. What has been out there for a couple of days, this isn't necessarily new, as John McClain pointed out, compensation had already been agreed to, but a deal hadn't been struck. And why is that? Because the any trade partner is trying to buy as much time, see as much clarity as they can get from two parts, from the legal, from the justice system, and also from the NFL before this November 2nd trade deadline. So I have long known that compensation had been agreed to, but no one wants to pull the trigger. They want to wait. So the first hurdle, and Dan, we'll get back to the legal stuff, is will Roger Goodell take him off the field in some way, shape, or form under the personal conduct policy or via the commissioner's exempt list? So we had a statement from Roger Goodell, who's over at the owners' meetings. He gave a kind of an interesting statement. This is from Ian Rappaport. This is Roger Goodell on Deshaun Watson. Quote, "We don't have all the access to that information and pride ourselves on not interfering with it. That process is ongoing." And he goes on, quote, "We don't feel we have that necessary information to place him on the exempt list," close quote. Roger Goodell has cleared that first hurdle, that at least that you and I have worried about. If a team trades for him, will he then be placed on the commissioner's exempt list? Roger Goodell is telling you in no unclear terms, as of today, unless they find out something new, unless they pull a 180, he will not be placed on the exempt list. I think that's his way of saying he's not going to be suspended, taken off the field. So that's number one. I think that's fair. I mean, before I go into legal stuff, I mean, I think that's fair.
That's a moving target, all right? I mean, the circumstances could change any day, every day, a week from now. That's not the kind of clarity that the Texans and the Dolphins in particular need. They're going to be transferring three number one draft choices. And I question the wisdom of a team that will probably be cleaning house, firing their general manager, who drafted Tua over, you know, my fantasy quarterback, Justin Herbert, and has made a colossal number of mistakes in building the franchise, that you have the owner interceding here, even though a new general manager and a new coach in all likelihood will be coming aboard in time for the 2022 season. I would say if you're the Dolphins, don't make that trade. You're not a Deshaun Watson away from competing. Maybe the Carolina Panthers are, but I want to point out one fact about the commissioner's exempt list. It is not something to be utilized at the whim of the commissioner months into an investigation. It has a very limited purpose and limited scope, which is that it's a device that's available to the NFL commissioner to use on a limited and temporary basis to permit the league to conduct an investigation. Well, this investigation started 7 months ago.
Right. That's the part to me as just like, you know, people keep asking, why didn't they do it before? I'm like, there is no answer to that question. If they weren't going to do it then, and Dan, you and I have been on this podcast going back and forth, I thought they should have done it a long time ago. And what's the catalyst to them doing it now? Nothing has really changed. They've interviewed 10 of the accusers. There's an 11th. If Roger Goodell doesn't think he has enough information after interviewing 10 accusers, the 11th isn't going to change it. The 12th isn't going to change it. The 20th isn't going to change it. Because what we've said all along, which I have thought gives a little bit of credibility to the claims, all these claims are pretty similar, right? That's the whole thing. And if he's listened to 10 people and those claims are pretty similar to the next 10 people, nothing's going to change. So here's the thing. And I don't want to lose sight of this, Dan. It's important. Actually, you know what? I'm going to call you on something. On this podcast, this very podcast, you told me that Justin Herbert, you didn't tell me he was your fantasy quarterback, but you said he was going to have a better year this year than Matt Stafford. And I'm checking the rankings right now. Matt Stafford, who I defended, I said for this year, I'd rather have Stafford. Number 6th ranked quarterback in fantasy football, Justin Herbert's 11th. So how about that, Dan? How about that?
Dan, I am disappointed in you because after what transpired 1 week ago, when Herbert had a bust out week and a much better week than Matthew Stafford, I laid low. I kept my powder dry because, you know what? I didn't want to make you feel bad over the fact that you selected
I'm
the wrong quarterback.
There's nothing to make me feel bad about. I am right in this debate. Okay, but hold on. I don't want to lose sight of the Watson thing.
What's the commissioner's example? It's not a PR tool used as a mechanism in order for the league to save face with its sponsors and the fans. It has a limited purpose to basically take the player off the field so the league can conduct an investigation, by the way, which has taken place here for more than half a year. It is a misuse of the policy if the commissioner is going to hang this over his head on a rolling basis.
Let's just play devil's advocate for a second, that Goodell is not going to put him on the exempt list, which that's seemingly what he's saying. That was the first hurdle. Okay. The second hurdle was finding a team that was willing to trade for him, despite what you and I have said all along, these allegations, be it civil or criminal, are not going away anytime soon. You can trust us as lawyers, right? Here's the first part. Whether criminal charges will be filed or not will be decided by a grand jury. It's not going to be decided by Roger Goodell. And that should have happened already. We'll have the next couple months. Maybe, maybe not. As I mentioned on Twitter, you know, recently, Ben Roethlisberger had sexual assault allegations, did not result in criminal charges, received a suspension anyway. So you still could be suspended even if the DA declines to pursue charges. But keep that as a man.
But Roethlisberger was accused of really violent sexual behavior. There was a question as to whether a rape occurred or a true sexual assault. I think that several degrees worse than what Watson is accused of doing.
But
not
to diminish
the accusations against Watson, though.
I'll still say, Dan, though, in our country, you are innocent until proven guilty. And Roethlisberger was not found guilty by a court of law, yet he still found a suspension. So certainly, the allegations are very different, but it's still some type of sexual assault allegation. But Dan,
Roethlisberger made some statements against Ben Roethlisberger. It was almost as if they wanted to go forward against Roethlisberger, and in declining to pursue prosecution, the prosecutor involved in that case made some damning accusations about Roethlisberger. I don't want to drag Ben Roethlisberger into this debate because I think the focus needs to be on what the commissioner is doing or not doing. And we're 7 months into an investigation, but we're also 8 months into a lawsuit where Tony Busby has essentially bought a civil index number, parked it, and done absolutely nothing. Go check the docket this morning.
Sure.
Nothing is taking place.
Well, I'm going to push back on you a little bit there, right? Because I know your standpoint that Busby has kind of filed this to parked it and been in a problem. Why has it been parked, Dan? Because I know at least why. The deposition schedule said depositions didn't have to be conducted until after the Super Bowl in February. I imagine that was Watson's attorney. That was a Rusty Harden decision to push this out until the season was over so it wouldn't be a distraction. So then this kind of brings me to the third point, right? Let's say there's no exempt list. There's no criminal charges. This civil case is not going away. If you just let the civil case play out, right? Depositions won't be conducted until February. Trial in this day and age might take a year plus, if not longer. And here's the thing. Let's say, right, even though you have the same attorney, this is not a class action lawsuit. Tony Busby can't decide whether all these cases will get settled. And what's this going to take? 21 different women of different sensibilities, different socioeconomic classes, different races, different ages, different ideas of whether they want to settle this case with money, I would think. And Watson's not going to settle the case, I wouldn't think, unless all of these accusers settle in one piece. But if you have one or two holdouts, let's say someone that has the financial means and they don't care about getting paid, they want to put Watson to the fire. That's in their control. That is not in Watson's control. So this case, whether or not he's suspended, whether or not criminal charges come, this case could hang over his head for a year, 2 years, if not longer, if the accusers wanted to.
Yeah, I'd be more concerned if the 22 accusers were represented by 22 different attorneys. They are represented by the same attorney who's essentially filed copycat or duplicative complaints in almost every lawsuit. So this, to me, seems more like the kind of situation where the attorney has a great deal of persuasion, sway, and control over the process. And if he advises these clients to settle the case, any recalcitrant ones who decline to take his advice, he could withdraw from the representation. And then look where they're going to be, you know, look where they're going to be left without counsel. And probably no one's going to come in to represent these people unless they're getting paid serious money. So I think Tony Busby has the ability and the wherewithal to settle these cases globally since he's representing every single accuser.
Well, there's also a world, right, Dan, where Tony Busby is forcing settlement on someone and saying, hey, it's my impression you should settle this case. It's a good amount of money. And one of these accusers, which I guess we'll get into a little bit, but one of these accusers might just say, you know what? I don't want to settle this. I'm going to pick a different attorney. I don't appreciate your legal guidance. But as at least as of now, Dan, you point out, as long as all these cases are under one roof, under one law firm, it's much better for Deshaun Watson's chances.
I tell you what, I'm more, you know, annoyed by the NFL's conduct here in the sense that they're kind of, dragging this along and leaving Deshaun Watson out on a limb here without any clarity with regard to the situation. Now, what can the player do? I mean, there hasn't been a disciplinary decision yet. You can't challenge it with a grievance going before an arbitrator. There's like no action to challenge. So could the, Dan, I'll give you a hypothetical. If the player is in danger of missing a number of games due to this lack of clarity, let's say the trade deadline passes and nothing is done, you're essentially looking at a situation where he's going to be sidelined for the rest of the season. Could Deshaun Watson potentially go into federal court? Maybe not before Judge Amos Mazant in the Eastern District of Texas, but when you have a very strong case of irreparable harm through missed games and no action being taken for this interminably long period of time, could there be some cognizable theory that the NFL is breaching its implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing under the CBA? I'm not sure that I would go down that road, but does Watson have any options, any points of entry where he could do something offensively?
I had this thought yesterday, Dan. We have a concept in criminal law called time served, right? Everyone's innocent until proven guilty, but if you sit in jail pending your trial and you end up being found guilty and you're sentenced to a year in jail, let's say you sat in prison for 6 months, you get credit for time served. So you only have to serve another 6 months. That's not happening with Deshaun Watson. Deshaun Watson he's not going to get credit for time served. It's almost Dan Lee.
But you just hit on it. That's the answer. That's right. Bingo, Daniel. He's already served the equivalent of six games of a suspension. This is de facto paid leave. The team isn't even playing him. He's been out six games.
I'll give you both sides of it. I've thought of it. I think it's interesting. Antonio Brown had a similar situation last year when no team would sign him because they weren't getting clarity from the NFL whether or not he was going to be suspended. I think it was a similar situation. You and I talked about it on the podcast. But here's the thing, Dan. This is the oddity of Deshaun Watson. I'll ask this just for our sports fans, right? If Deshaun Watson isn't being punished and the NFL is telling us today as of, you know, late October, that he's always been eligible to play, why hasn't Deshaun Watson been playing? Right? I don't understand that. It's not a holdout situation. Deshaun Watson reported. He's on the active roster. It doesn't make sense in the history of NFL holdouts, right, or NBA holdouts. Ben Simmons wasn't reporting to camp for a period of time. Le'Veon Bell over the Steelers wasn't reporting. Deshaun Watson's there. He wants to play, so you can't call this a holdout. I think the Texans would fight back, Dan, and say, the reason we weren't playing you is because we were trying to protect our asset. You demanded a trade. I think you're going to have a colorable argument on both sides, but I'm with you. I think it's patently unfair to Deshaun Watson. Say what you want about the guy off the field, but on the field, I don't think this is a fair shake for Watson.
Yeah, Dan, let's assume that the NFL wraps up its investigation and, you know, given what's been alleged in the civil complaint, do you think this merits a one-year suspension? This would merit, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of between 4, 6 to 8 games, right? There's no violence involved.
I might disagree. I mean, listen, just look at the history of punishment in the NFL, right? Ben Roethlisberger was given 6 games, and I was looking into it yesterday. Different situation. Maybe it was more serious charges. But there was a pattern with respect to Roethlisberger. 2 accusers in basically a 2-year period. You know, we don't have that many examples of this in the NFL, but this would be some evidence of some type of a pattern. Maybe it's not quality, right? It's not an allegation of rape, at least as far as I'm aware. But 20 civil sexual assault allegations might require an intense punishment. It's possible. could get a year for that. I can't rule that out, certainly. I mean, it's not to us to say what's worse, right? One really bad accusation or 20 not as bad, but still pretty bad allegations, right? What's worse?
Yeah, I guess the point I was driving at is if we're going to land at an eventual punishment of 6 games or 8 games, hasn't he already served that? I mean, if you're talking about time served and being on the inactive list or not being, you know, he's one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL and the Texans are electing to sideline him. He's serving a de facto paid leave right now. And we're already through 6 games. So how many more games of a suspension would he actually have to serve? And I think the National Football League is doing a disservice to Watson, to the Texans, and to 31 other teams by leaving this out there unresolved. I mean, how much time is needed for the NFL to make a determination where the standard of proof is a lot lower than it would be in a criminal setting where you need proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
All I'll say is this, Dan, inconsistent. This is not consistent. Yep. And this has been my whole point the whole time. You can look at Roethlisberger. You can look at Ezekiel Elliott. Yep. A number of NFL cases in the past. You could even look at the DeAndre Baker situation last year with this felony armed robbery assault charge. They were quick to put him on the exempt list. So I don't know. I can't tell you. I just know that it seems inconsistent. Dan, I don't know if I have anything else on Watson. Let's see where he gets traded. We have a contractual obligation, the city of St. Louis. We are the guys covering this lawsuit. Charles Robinson has joined us on this quest. Mike Florio has been on it for a while. But there's still an alarmingly few amount of people that are on this lawsuit. Dan, we had a pretty big update, at least in the legal world, when the lead trial attorney gets taken off the case, essentially on the eve of trial. That's worth paying attention to. Dan, I know you were all over it. Tell us the latest in the case.
Well, the city of St. Louis, county of St. Louis, and the St. Louis Regional Stadium and Complex Authority are the three plaintiffs. They are represented by two sets of law firms. One of the firms has a lawyer, I guess, lead lawyer by the name of Bob Blitz. Phenomenal name. If you're going to be suing a football team, right?
Actually, he did not create the Blitz video game back in the day. Dan, did you ever play that?
No, I played Space Invaders. So this is a little bit after my time.
There's a generational difference here. NFL Blitz. Yeah. But go ahead.
So the city of St. Louis has two different sets of trial lawyers. The NFL went after Bob Blitz, who's sort of the big trial lawyer name on the team, who's presumably going to be taking or would be taking the lead role in examining witnesses, making the opening statement. And the NFL filed a motion to disqualify him because Bob Blitz has worn several hats here. He's not only the city of St. Louis's trial attorney, but when the city was trying to persuade the NFL to build or to keep the team in St. Louis, Mr. Blitz was the co-chair of the stadium task force, which was working with the National Football League and trying to convince the league to keep the team in St. Louis. So he's a fact witness as well as the trial lawyer, and the ethical rules in just about every state forbid a lawyer from acting as a witness at trial. It's called the advocate witness rule. There are some procedural requirements that I think the moving party would have to satisfy. You have to move or object at the earliest possible opportunity. And this witness or this lawyer has to be so critical that nobody else can provide testimony about the material fact about which he's testifying. And Judge McGraw granted the NFL's motion to DQ, Mr. Blitz, on the basis of his work with the stadium task force. But I've surmised online, and I've talked with a number of Missouri or St. Louis attorneys, and they believe that the judge was being careful and cautious here because he didn't want to have a situation where in a close call, he would have denied the motion for disqualification. St. Louis wins big at the trial, and then the NFL appeals on the basis of Judge McGraw's refusal to disqualify Blitz. So two different lawyers, both of whom are partners in major firms, have told me that they believe that the judge was being careful here and making sure that the eventual trial wouldn't have to go to a do-over based upon this, disqualification issue. So he may have done the city of St. Louis a huge favor by disqualifying Blitz.
People have asked, and I made sure I clipped it. I remember what came up. This came up in the town hall, this particular question. I think we were all on the same page, and I will shout out Randy Carricker in particular. We all thought that this motion was not going to prevail because of when it was filed, not the substance. I think we could all say there's probably some inherent conflict here. And to Randy's point, maybe Bob Blitz is more dangerous as a witness and then as a lawyer, right? So there's this whole rule I don't know what the exact rule is in St. Louis, but we have it in New York, we have it in every state. The lawyer as a witness rule, right? It's unfair, patently unfair. If you're the trial attorney in the case and you're also on the witness stand, that doesn't really seem to make sense. So that's what was always somewhat of an inherent conflict here. But I think Bob Blitz said there's other people that can testify to my part. I think that was the version, at least in his head. Now, here's the thing. We all thought it would be denied because it was filed so late. I think the judge here kind of split the baby a little bit, right? Takes Bob Blitz off the case, and splitting the baby is, who's that, King Solomon, Dan? Is that a King Solomon reference?
Yes, it was. I remember that fable very well from Hebrew school. So
they go, right, this is just a fun. We use it in the law too, right? There's a baby, right? One mom claims the baby's hers. The other mom claims the baby's hers. And King Solomon's like, you know what? I'm going to cut the baby in half and you guys can each have one half of the baby. So obviously the real mom said, no. Fake mom can have the baby.
I'm not buying that story. There was no corroboration. Where's the sourcing on that? Are you kidding me? If I tried to write something like that in The Athletic, I'd be taken to task by my editors. You gotta have corroboration.
I actually think King Solomon will be charged with attempted murder because he's basically threatening to slice baby in half. But the expression we use it in the law is kind of finding a compromise in the middle. So here's the thing. Bob Blitz is kicked off the case, but what gets to stay, and this is the important part, that the deposition testimony that Bob Blitz took, that he elicited from NFL owners, that gets to stick. So that's a much bigger part of the case. If that was somehow excluded, Dan, what do they redo depositions at this point? That would be insane.
Well, first of all, why should the fact that Blitz's name is on a deposition transcript, you know, poison the jury? I mean, there are protective measures that the court can take. First of all, these witnesses, John Maurer, you know, Clark Hunt, Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, they should be live witnesses at the trial. But to the extent that they are unavailable and wish not to participate, these deposition transcripts become quite important. And Mr. Blitz is the lawyer asking the question, right, and the court can simply, you know, black out the name or just say, right, lawyer asks.
Question, colon, in like, and yeah, that's it. Doesn't matter who it's from.
Which leads me to suspect that the NFL brought this motion as a tactical maneuver, and courts have, you know, cautioned about the misuse of the disqualification motions as a sort of a weapon, to weaponize it as a tool to remove counsel, which is why the requirement is that the moving party needs to file the motion as expeditiously as possible and not wait until the end of the game. But there's a wrinkle here under Missouri law. It's not just the filing of the motion. If the NFL had objected to it early in the proceedings, then that preserves their right later on to move for his disqualification. And Judge McGraw recognized in his opinion that the NFL did object to Mr. Blitz's involvement as trial counsel, which is the saving grace and why their motion was not dismissed as an improper procedural attempt to get rid of a lawyer. But he kept in the important part of it, which was the deposition testimony. And the city of St. Louis is going to be no worse for wear. They've got like four of the lawyers.
Motion for the remainder of this podcast and any further podcast. We cannot call him Mr. Blitz. I think he exclusively has to be called Bob Blitz. It just rolls off the tongue. So, Randy, I just want to shout Randy out, and then we'll kick it to our guests and she'll be joining us shortly. But Randy pointed out, and I think this is the big takeaway from the case. Bob Blitz is a pretty effective witness. Right. So pick your poison. Right. If you want to kick him off the case, fine. And I think people in St. Louis were a little concerned about this ruling. And I said, it's not that big of a deal. You have competent lawyers. Dan, the truth is, if St. Louis gave you and I 90 days to figure out this trial and present the case on their behalf, I'm pretty sure we would do a competent job. Now, we haven't been attached to the case for years. You know who has been attached to the case? The co-counsel law firm, other attorneys in Bob Blitz's firm. Those guys have been on the case in the weeds for years. They're going to be certainly capable. And now what the NFL has done is they're saying we're going to put Bob Blitz on the witness stand. So the question I got from Randy Carrico, which I think is a good one, I think you and I will have the same opinion here. Question is the NFL required to call Bob Blitz as a witness? And I said, well, they just made this whole motion saying that he was an indispensable witness. And it would be seemingly in bad faith if they made this motion to kick Bob Blitz off as trial attorney and then they didn't call him as a witness. I think Judge McGraw would blow a gasket if that happened. I don't know if they're technically required to call any particular witness, but if they didn't do it, I think it would just be a horrendous look for them.
Well, maybe the city of St. Louis would call Blitz as part of their case in chief. They're the plaintiffs with the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence that the NFL did not adhere or follow its own relocation guidelines. I would think that Bob Blitz is a witness that can advance the ball on that case in chief. And I would think that the city would want to use him offensively as a witness and not necessarily wait for the National Football League to call him. And of course, anyone who's attending the trial is going to miss out on the spectacle of Bob Blitz taking the examination of Bob Blitz and basically running back and forth between the two chairs. And as a result of Judge McGraw's ruling, we're going to miss out on that spectacle. But in the end, I don't think it's going to make any difference at all as far as the quality of the advocacy or the outcome. Certainly, the city, if it had its druthers, would rather have Bob Blitz as part of the trial team. But the truth is he's going to remain part of the trial team. He just is going to have a role in the background as a strategist in the war room and not before the jury in a public setting.
So essentially, Bob Blitz is going to be pulling the strings behind the scenes either way. I think it's a, you know, it's not necessarily a win for the city of St. Louis, but it's a win to keep all the deposition testimony in. And Dan, to the extent that they had to redo the depositions for some reason, if they could have excluded it, then the NFL would have had a heads up as to what city of St. Louis's goal would have been. So I think the big win is keeping the deposition testimony intact. And yeah, for seemingly the substantive merits of the case, we're preserving the status quo. You're just changing the lawyer at the top here.
Yeah, and before, I know we've got a guest coming on with Fred, but we've got two other things to look for this week. Fred's joining us any second. So one thing to look out for this week is potential ruling on the motion to change venue from the Missouri Court of Appeals. We'll update everybody on that as it happens. So let's bring in our guest, Fred Siegel.
Just a little bit about Fred. Fred is the man that runs at Old Takes Exposed. Freezing Cold Takes maybe is better known. But Fred, before we kick it to him, was, I think still is, we'll see if we can get the true word from him, was trained as an attorney, right? He's the guy that everyone tags. His notifications are constantly blowing up. So we'll kick it to Fred to explain his background. And after we're done with Fred, we'll get a little bit into the Chicago Blackhawks stuff and also the Cleveland Guardians lawsuit. Without further ado, we will send it over to Fred Siegel. Fred, welcome to Conduct Detrimental. Our listeners will know you as at Old Takes Exposed. But again, as we mentioned, many people don't know that you are actually a lawyer. You have a JD in your background. So what's it like to be back amongst lawyers in the legal ranks?
It's great. At least it's to talk about it. It's been a while. It's been like a couple of years. Yeah, but I mean, I practiced law for like 8 years.
What kind of practice area did you focus in? Litigation?
Healthcare transactions like mergers, acquisitions, just regular contracts for doctors, hospitals.
The reason we wanted to have you on, we do, for our podcast, we do a lot of sports law topics, but, you know, I think a lot of people that tune into this are lawyers and law students that are interested in maybe non-traditional paths from law school. So certainly Dan and my path's a little non-traditional, Dan going into sports betting law and me being a, you know, Twitter lawyer / sports law guy. Now, Fred, you have completely reinvented the wheel. You are not just, you know, a lawyer that is on Twitter. You've created this incredible platform. Let's start in. It's Freezing Cold Takes. Everyone knows it. Everyone's seen it. I'm sure everyone that's listening to us has tagged you, and you've told me sometimes you have to turn off notifications because you get too much pinging on your end. But I'll give it to you. I'll give you the floor, my friend. How did this thing get started? How did this concept of Old Takes Exposed, Freezing Cold Takes, how did that take off?
Well, it was all by accident. I was starting a bunch of feeds that, you know, would mess with people. I had a spelling error one of a guy who like took everything literally. And then like, I would just make all these different feeds, but then I saw all sorts of journalists would pat themselves on the back for the things they got right. Oh, just like I predicted yesterday, this happened and stuff like that. So, but then I was just like, I remember the same guy, the same journalist predicted this one thing and it was totally off and they didn't say anything about that. So I said, I'm just going to make something to post those, you know? And Twitter has very good search function. It's like Westlaw. Mm-hmm. The searches are very similar concept in that way. So I just started looking them up. But you always remember like a journalist or reporter who says something about your team. They don't even remember. Or like a TV guy, there's like 3 hours a day of TV. They don't even remember. You remember.
Was there a point where you were doing, you know, the cold takes, freezing cold takes, Old Takes Exposed, and practicing law at the same time?
Yes, for two, three years, probably. Yeah.
How did you do that? I mean, I almost had to leave my law firm. I was at Becker and Polyakov. You may have heard of them. I was a partner at Becker, and then around 2015, I started to sort of get a little bit more visible in social media around sports betting, Deflategate. And I had to make a choice. I couldn't juggle the two. I want to hear how you pulled that off because you had to be more engaged on a day-to-day basis on your general area than I had to be in mine where I could just cherry pick the topics.
Well, the first year or two, you know, I would like limit it during the day to like two or three posts. So, you know, I would check the computer if there was like some sort of news and then I'd look it up myself or people would start sending them to me to mm-hmm. post. And then, but if something big happened, I would get a little distracted. Oh, if something big happened during the day, like there was a trade or something got fired. It wasn't that bad, but it was annoying. You know, I didn't really like focus that hard on making sure I had something out there, like at a specific time, so I could just do it whenever.
Yeah, I try to play the game a little bit myself now that I've discovered this, the greatest search engine after Twitter, which is newspapers.com.
Yeah, I use that.
Oh my God, I looked for stuff. I wanted to find somebody who would say Wayne Gretzky is going to be a bust or Mark Messier is going to be a bust. And this stuff goes all the way back to the 1950s.
Yeah. Gretzky's hard because Gretzky was like the next great thing from like the moment he was out on the ice. I've looked that up myself. Messier may be different, I guess.
Yeah, some reporter in Edmonton said, you know, the kid is overwhelmed. And they got to send him down to the minor leagues.
Right.
You found that too?
Well, no, I just like, I guess like stuff like that. Like I saw one of those about Brett Hull's first year when he was in Calgary. Brett Hull, but like, well, I'm sure, yeah, there's stuff like that. He needs to be sent down to the minors and stuff like that. But Wayne Gretzky was always like the guy. But his story about how he got to Edmonton is like 16 years old. And they bought him off like the AHL or something. It was very, very
good. He was supposed to be eligible for the NHL draft when the WHA and NHL sort of combined and four WHA teams were folded in. He should have been eligible for the draft. And the problem was that the Colorado Rockies had the number one overall pick in 1979. And he didn't want to play for the Rockies. So I think he signed a personal services contract with Nelson Pocklington or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was some threat of litigation, which is the reason why Gretzky was able to be grandfathered in and not be subjected to the NHL draft. There are so many amazing stories. And you could take your site, your tweets, and you could take this back a century because of newspapers.com.
I've been using a lot. I mean, I have a book coming out in September about all these cold takes for the NFL.
Oh, I saw it. That's coming out. I thought it was in the past. That's a new one?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with the Amazon.com thing because
it's on Amazon. I checked it out on
Amazon as if it's the same book. Same book. I don't know why it's up because anyone who's ever looked is confused about it. But I don't talk about it. I don't talk about it yet because I don't want people to get confused. So I mean, when the official date and like the manuscript's in and everything, then I'll start talking about it. But I have all these different cold takes, and it's, a lot of it's from that site, newspaper.com. Newspaper.com also has great stuff like the broadcast notes from, let's say there's a writer who would do TV notes for each paper. It was a big deal at the time. They would just give quotes from like the broadcast about it. Like the broadcast, and it has a lot of stuff, material. Like it would say, guess what Vern Lundquist said about the Dolphins today? You know, like it may have a quote, you know, like during the game broadcast, because you can't get all the games. Like you can't watch all the games. They don't have them.
I've certainly been impressed, Fred, of your ability across sports. Even today, I'm looking at your feed. You had some random Atlanta fan was like questioning Buster Olney's tweet as to why the Braves needed to add pieces at the trade deadline. And like, I don't know how you find these things. Just like,
well, that's a good one. Because
it was amazing.
Twitter's coming out with a lot of better stuff, like the quote tweet function. So what you do, I mean, I didn't have that until like a couple of years ago where they started putting the quote tweets where you could just press the quote tweets and see them. That was harder for me because those don't come up in the search. Like that wouldn't come up in a search for a trade deadline because it was a tweet about Buster Olney saying that the Braves are going to still go and try to buy in the trade deadline. And the quote tweet was just why. Well, that wouldn't show up in a search because the tweet that's quote tweeted does not come up in the search. So what you do is you find a tweet about it from somebody prominent that's like big. So anything with Adam Schefter or like Ian Rappaport posting the initial thing about a trade, you could look at the quote tweets because everybody's going to comment on it. So that's what I did with that when I found that Buster Olney tweet because I knew the trade deadline, the Braves. There were many people just saying like the Braves shouldn't do anything.
So Fred, I had you on the podcast, not for this particular reason, but I'm going to call you out for something. Remember I told you that this Cleveland Guardians thing was going to be potentially.
Yeah. You're really into that.
The news this morning, Fred?
I saw it. I thought about you. Yeah. So what are they trying to gouge them?
So the Cleveland Guardians, we're going to talk about it. We could do it here too, but the Cleveland Guardians roller derby team has sued Cleveland baseball team. So it should give you fodder, Fred, for like.
They don't care. Cleveland Guardians. They want money, right?
They want money. But the problem is you had all these people, at least associated with Cleveland baseball team, saying the trademark is not an issue. Welcome in the new era of the Cleveland
right.
Free and clear. So, you know, I follow, you know, that stuff's certainly good for you. And then, Fred, the other topic that we've been hitting early and often, Washington football team. You had some good ones, which I sent you the other day, right? You have the president of the organization, Bruce Allen, saying like, hey, it's a new era of Washington football. Like,
right.
Don't run over here. And it's like, there's been incompetency and toxic workplace culture for a decade straight. So, I mean, I just.
The Washington football team one. Bruce Allen's a great one. I mean, there's one quote about Bruce Allen from Daniel Snyder. There's a tweet about that.
Oh.
It always goes around, like from when he was hired back in 2010. You can go back all the way to 2010. You don't remember anymore.
So I guess a little bit behind the scenes, right? Like what we do on our show is we call out some of these big institutions that people are afraid to call out. So we've been doing a lot of stuff on the St. Louis Rams lawsuit. People are afraid to cover this lawsuit. Like we're not really afraid to do it. We're not, you know, no one's really.
No reason to be afraid. We're not affiliated with anybody.
But some people are afraid. People are afraid to call out owners and different stuff, right? People are
You're not affiliated with them. And it's good for you now. I mean, like, I don't know if they care that much about you guys doing it unless it starts to latch on to someone else.
Why your platform is so big, why you have over 500,000 followers on Twitter, and I'm sure probably a million followers across all your various platforms, is because you call out everyone. Right. That the whole account exists to call people out and keep and hold people accountable. So,
right. I mean, it could be even better if I called people out professionally and stuff like that. But then it takes a lot of work. Like you have to have a huge basis for what you're doing. And I don't know if I have the bandwidth or even to think about stuff like that, but calling out for the takes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I try not to call them out professionally or insult them personally. You just post the take.
Do you have a preference as to whether you call out members of the media or how about like, you know, team executives that extol the virtues of the draft choice they made or the trade they made?
Very in my head. It's just like these fluid rules that I go by. If it's just like, you know, if you pick a guy with your draft pick, if it's cliche or pretty common that it's going to happen, then, you know, it's harder for me to reconcile doing it. They pick a player, you know, they're going to hype up that player. So it's like, almost like, you know, I could do it's low hanging fruit, just like boxing, any combat sport, the fighters spend like a month making the boldest exclamations about how they're going to knock the other guy out because that's what they're trained to do in order to make their fight big. Because they have to do it to promote their fight. And then I get all those after the fight. And it's like, you get this with every single fight. Like there's no fight where the person's not going to say they're going to knock the other guy out.
My favorite, Fred, and you bring it up. It's not necessarily when you post the old takes exposed that we've seen 100 times. My favorite is when you just put the writing emoji as if like, you jotted this down in your notebook as if you will bring this up later. And it does, whether you know it or not, it holds people accountable. I phrase my tweets very differently, knowing there are people like,
you got to put like, you know, I believe, or this could happen.
Right now, you have to be very careful because, Fred, you follow me now. This is dangerous. If I say anything,
I don't go through my feed that much. So if I follow you, I'm still not going to see your posts that much. Like I don't go through my scroll down my feed that much. So I may not see all your stuff, but I don't do the writing emoji that much anymore because people just are so annoying about it afterwards. I do that a lot now. I used to do that because everybody would tag me. I get like 100 different tags, the same post. So if I replied with the writing emoji, that means like everyone could see right under that I got it. But then people use it as if I was making the prediction that it's not going to come true. They pull it back on every single time.
I'm not going to put my guard down, Fred. When you followed me, I treated this akin to the Steve Buscemi in Madison. That you put me on a list. That you're coming after me, and I got to be very careful. I think everyone, no one's going to let their guard down from hearing this. We're all...
I probably follow you because you followed me. I do the follow backs.
That's it. That's the reason, of course.
Well, that's not how you got to 500,000 followers. I loved your writing emoji when there was that response to the Uber facts about something happening 4 million years
ago. Oh, yeah. I get those a lot. Those are fun. Yeah.
All right.
I have to ask you. Like an end of the world declaration.
Are you a Miami Dolphins fan at all? Did you grow up following the Dolphins?
Oh, yeah.
And how much would it have been amazing for you to have been doing your account at the time, the Nick Saban, Drew Brees, Dante Culpepper episode occurred? Do you have a tweet for that?
The Drew Brees thing and the Dante Culpepper thing, the Drew Brees thing was kind of like, it was a surprise that he became so good. He was pretty good for the Chargers, and then the act of possibly signing him wasn't like supposed to be seen as something that would have changed our franchise. It would have just been like, oh, we're signing a young quarterback who didn't play as much for the Chargers but looks pretty good, you know? And then we signed Culpepper, and everyone thought Culpepper was good too. So, the Saints were pretty happy with Brees. But, yeah, some of that stuff, the Nick Saban one's really good. The Dolphins won maybe their first game ever against the Broncos, I think it was. They crushed them.
Yeah,
maybe the first or second. And Saban was really – they were really high on him after that.
Yeah, he had a very good first year, I think.
Year,
and then, of course,
first year with a bad quarterback. It was like a backup quarterback maybe. It may have been like Gus Frerotte or one of those guys. Yeah, so they were really high on him. And then the quarterback was supposed to change everything after his first year.
Is it okay to talk about your book? Do you want to promote it a little bit? Because I learned about it today. And what Dan and I have discovered about our own accounts and the engagement is that the National Football League is king. All the best, you know, responses and highest level of engagement comes around the NFL, far and away by many multiples over any other sport. Is that true in your world and with your account as well?
For the most part, but NBA can be, there's a very strong social NBA scene that loves just all that Twitter stuff. And you post something about some of these NBA players and it's automatic, like there's going to be a ton of people who are going to really try. I mean, there's just hot button players like Kyrie, Carmelo Anthony, of course, LeBron, KD, like all those guys, you post about them and it's going to be a lot. Like NBA, there's a big group of fans and they really just push everything on Twitter. It's like this like really kind of like cultish thing. And the NBA kind of isn't as popular as NFL, so it's more of like a cultish thing. So that too, NBA, I would say is up there. And but the NFL, there's just more stuff people care about. There's more of a breadth of stuff that people care about. You can post about any team in the NFL. It'll be anything. You'll get a huge response. The NBA has to be about specific teams, specific players.
What's your favorite anecdote out of the book? And tell us a little bit about your book, the title, and when it's going to be coming out and how somebody could purchase it, because this is an exciting development. This is going to be your first, you know, long form book to take, you know, your old takes exposed into the publishing world. So can you tell us a little bit about the book?
The book comes out on in September, and it's about, I guess you can get it on Amazon. It's really confusing. I did not publicize it yet. I do not publicize it because of that, but it's...
This is your book tour right now. I hope you realize this. This is the whole book tour right here.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping I can get on more stuff, but I'd love to come back on, like, to talk about it even in more detail when that comes around, like at that time when it's near publication. But it's about like just taking stories. It's stories of certain particular circumstances that generated either one big freezing cold take or a lot of cold takes surrounding it. And it's, you know, I have a certain amount of words. It was very difficult to determine what I would do it about. There's definitely things that I could have written a 2,000 page book about stuff, cold takes, but I kind of limited to a lot to players or situations where somebody was underhyped by the media and then turned out to be great. I didn't want to go on chapters about like a player who failed just to like, it just seemed very kind of mean to do a whole chapter about why this guy, do a whole chapter on Johnny Manziel, like 30 pages of just ripping him, you know, like of why making fun of him, you know? So I kind of left that out a little bit, but I have like my favorite stories from the Dolphins in 93. Like I used to have season tickets to the Dolphins. Scott Mitchell played really well for two games. Dan Marino got hurt. It was his first time he got hurt. He had been there for 10 years as starting quarterback with Dolphins. And he got hurt. He tore his Achilles against the Browns. It was a non-contact injury. And Scott Mitchell came in, and he was the backup. He had been the backup of the Dolphins for 3 years, so he knew the offense really well. Mm-hmm. And he played well for 2.5 games. He won that one, the Browns game, and then like culminated in like around Halloween time. They beat the Chiefs at home. And I think Chiefs had Joe Montana, we crushed him. Mitchell played great. And that's when Greg Cody from the Miami Herald wrote, trade Dan Marino, keep Scott Mitchell. And that's like the original cold take. Like, yeah. So I wrote all about that. I talked to Greg Cody. I talked to some of the players and, you know, find all the things about it in the, you know, he had to go on to the day he wrote the article. He went on the sports show in Miami. It was Jimmy Cephalo was the host. Jimmy Cephalo is now he's a former Dolphin player. He's now the play-by-play guy on the Dolphins radio, but he was hosting a show like on Channel 4 or whatever, local station. He had Cody from the Miami Herald building, like on a live remote, and they pixelated his face, mm-hmm. like as a joke. Like he's in witness protection now. He can't know where he is. He was getting booed all from the, but there's a lot of stuff on that. So that's like a whole chapter like about that. And what led up to it and afterwards. And I spoke with guys like Scott Mitchell and stuff like that. So like that's really kind of what it's about. There's one on chapter on Steve Young and Joe Montana. Great material there. And yeah. Dallas Cowboys from the 90s.
Fred, I think, listen, you said, can you come back on the podcast and talk more about the book? Sure. But in exchange, we're going to have to get immunity from any of our further.
No, I can't do that because. You know, the integrity of the feed. People call it. all the new cold take feeds coming out.
Yeah,
they don't have a
chapter. Yeah, you have a chapter on Belichick.
I have a Belichick chapter. I have. There's so much Patriots stuff. I had to whittle it down to Belichick, and then Patriots from 2001 to 2004 because I didn't want it to be a book totally on the Patriots. There's one. Brett Favre and Reggie White is a good chapter. Brett Favre, Reggie White, Mike Holmgren, the Packers from that time. Brett Favre, when they traded for Favre because they gave up a first round pick for him. And no one knew who he was. And then Reggie White, signing of Reggie White. You'll like this, the free agency stuff. You know, the whole thing about free agency, that's a fun read for you if you wanted to look like how free agency started as sports law.
The guest who created that, Jim Quinn, trial lawyer from Wal Gotchel and Manges. He argued the case. I don't know if it was the Marvin Powell case, but his efforts led to NFL free agency in the early 90s. Great segue into you.
Right. Yeah. So there's in free agency, like the owners obviously did not want it. They're throwing out all these different theories of why they shouldn't have it. One of them was that, you know, no one's going to go to these small market teams because, you know, everyone's going to go to the big market teams where they get paid a lot of money and they go to and places that are more desirable, like Miami, LA, San Diego, New York. So Keith Byers immediately said, like, well, that's ridiculous. There's only two players at running back. There's only one, like, no one, not everybody's going to go to play for this one team. And then they implemented the salary cap. So that changed that because teams couldn't just pay an exorbitant amount of money for each player. But then they started using the argument that no one's going to go to places like Green Bay. Buffalo. No one's going to go to those places because like Green Bay is a small town. It's really cold. And they said all that. And Reggie White immediately, the first free agency, he was the prime golden free agent for that class and went to Green Bay. It just changed the entire narrative right away. And there's a lot of stuff about, first of all, that people saying he'll never go there. And second of all, there were people who said like it wasn't worth it. And he signed like a 4-year, $17 million deal at the time. But no one really knew what to do with like the salary cap and like whatever. It's like no one really knew how the impact.
So, Fred,
people signing would be. So,
say like in history, right? You know, it's hard to run for president nowadays because everything from your past is going to be brought up. It's hard to be in sports media nowadays, Fred, because we have people like you roaming the sidelines and taking people out with a sniper rifle.
Well, you know, if you don't...
It's good, though.
The people who thrive in media don't care about me. I mean, I'm talking about, like, just pure sports takes.
I disagree.
With your law stuff, I mean, you have to be accurate with all the things that you say when you're, like, reporting on this stuff. So it's not even about with you about, like, cold takes, per se. It's, like, accuracy. But people who... like all these people on TV, they don't care. They don't care. And they're just looking for something. They're not even looking. The first thing they're thinking about is what's going to be something I could say that's going to generate a lot of people talking about it. Who actually they think is going to win is completely secondary.
Fred, thank you so much for joining us. When the book is available, you will let us know. We will punch it out everywhere. But as everyone's hearing, it sounds like there's a lot of good cold takes exposed in there. Fred, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
That was Fred Siegel of Old Takes Exposed, a.k.a. Freezing Cold Takes. So as Fred mentioned, lawyer turned social media poster extraordinaire and coming out with a book. I don't know when the book will be available, but we will certainly post it and publish it and probably have Fred back on.
He doesn't seem real eager about promoting it. He was angry that Amazon had advertising around it, like too soon, too soon. I love it.
We were trying to promote it for him and give him the link. He goes, no, don't do that. So listen, that'll be really good. He wants to promote on his own terms, which, listen, he is the gatekeeper of Twitter. We have to abide by Fred's terms. So the big story today, we said we were going to make sure we got this out on an emergency level, not necessarily an emergency podcast. We're covering other topics, but Cleveland Guardians is a topic we've dedicated so much to on this podcast. And it was a topic near and dear to me, at least. That was our first article on the website that really went viral. Zach Kurtz, the sneaker lawyer, basically, was one of a few people on Team Conduct Detrimental that covered this extensively. And we've really been the, you know, speaking of the gatekeepers of Twitter, we've been the gatekeepers of the story. Someone mentioned in my replies today, Dan, that Conduct Detrimental willed this lawsuit into existence, which I would take, I'll take great pride
well,
in.
Well, one half of Conduct Detrimental willed it into existence, Dan. I was skeptical.
You didn't believe in it.
Yeah, because how moronic could an organization that has a $2 billion net worth, they wouldn't not going to do a Google search? I didn't believe it. I thought, okay, this is like rampant speculation, and it turned out to be true. So I'm not going to take credit for willing it into existence. I tried to will it out of existence. So your success, my failure, no doubt about it.
Yeah, but this is why our podcast works, Dan, because we see eye to eye on a lot of things, but when we don't see eye to eye, it makes for great radio on a number of levels. So here's the catch up for anyone that does not know. A federal lawsuit was filed in Ohio by the Cleveland Guardians roller derby team against the baseball team, arguing what we've said on this whole podcast the whole time, that Cleveland baseball stole the name and didn't provide just compensation. So we said they should have settled up with them ahead of time on two things, on the trademark, number one, and the website, number two. And Cleveland, you know, roller derby has been very silent, other than kind of kicking the website back into gear. They haven't really made any statements. Anytime I've tried to reach out to them for comment, you know, I have some connections there. No one wants to speak on the record. So whatever, I can't get anyone to speak. Guess what? They came out swinging with a haymaker, and they're essentially saying that, you know, all this fun stuff, and well, you know, the August 5th episode, I found it for everyone. I posted it on social media. That's when we had Josh Gerben on. We did a full breakdown. I'll tell you guys to look at that I listened to it again this morning. It has everything and more that you're looking for. But that was this weird kind of filing and offsite in Mauritius, you know, this country in the continent of Africa that Major League Baseball tried to hide away the secret trademark filing. So that's the nexus of this lawsuit, that Major League Baseball tried to secretly do this filing. And when it became public that they were going with the Guardians, the roller derby team, roller derby team reached out and they said, hey, by the way, you're taking our name. And baseball seemed to have kind of like swatted them away with the, hey, we'll give you peanuts for the website, but yeah, you know, we're not going to give you that much. And that's just this lawsuit. We predicted it. I listened on our last episode with Gerben on the August 5th episode. We said there could be a federal lawsuit filed under the genesis of common law trademark, that they've used this name in commerce since 2013. And unless they abandon the mark, Dan, they have the common law trademark. So this could get really messy for Cleveland baseball very quickly. And we've said all along, why pick a name that A, you haven't settled with, you don't have the IP to, there might be a common law trademark out there, but B, there might've been better names out there. So I think this was a colossal, colossal mistake. And Dan, we planted our flag on this story first. So I'm excited that it's getting to another level.
I think we're planting our flag on so many stories. I mean, right? St. Louis Rams, the Guardians. I mean, one after another, when we immerse ourselves in a sports law controversy, we've been pretty good about owning it. And usually more important than owning it is being insightful, correct, and projecting where things may turn next. And I think you've been batting 1,000 with the Guardians case, and together we're batting 1,000 on St. Louis and more of the same. And they're not just lucky guesses. We do our work. We really are passionate about this, and we dig into the details, do legal research. So unsurprising. So what I can't understand, though, Dan, is why didn't the Indians just offer something like in the neighborhood of $1 million or $2 million? That would have been avoiding all these issues. It's not a large sum of money considering the value of what the IP would be worth.
Let us remind everyone, our podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. Themis Bar Review, the best bar review prep company out there. They cover all things when it comes to the preparation of law students, just like we cover here. All things at the intersection of sports and law. To the extent you want to learn more about Themis, go to themisbar.com/condetrimental, and you will learn all about why we keep talking about Themis on this podcast.
Watch this, Dan, okay? From the Cleveland Indians, okay, name with some Native American connotations. We talked about the Washington Redskins, a name with a lot of Native American connotations they had to change. Both those teams had to change their names. We've talked about those trademark issues on the podcast. Now, Dan, we're not going to talk about this on the podcast, but we have spent prior episodes talking about the Washington football team investigation. Now, that story is still ongoing. We'll continue to touch upon that. But I think there's a lot of question marks as to how that was investigated and what was done wrong. Now, over in the NHL, Dan, coincidentally, a third team with Native American imagery, the Chicago Blackhawks, finds themselves in a lot of trouble for failing to do a proper investigation on their end. Dan, give us the latest on the Blackhawks stuff. It's maybe a story we have to hit again.
Sure. I think it needs an entire episode. But in contrast to the lack of transparency with the NFL's investigation of WFT, the Blackhawks, for all their failings back in 2010, they have been completely transparent with the public and authorized their law firm, Jenner & Block, to release the entire 100-page investigative report. And what I find fascinating about this is that it's happening juxtaposed at the same time as the National Football League is under a cloud of controversy and accusations and being hauled before Congress about their lack of transparency. Why don't they issue the report? Why don't they issue the emails? Why don't they come clean with names, dates, and emails like the Blackhawks have willingly done? And I think the dichotomy there is just so stunning, considering they're roughly about the same overall topic and they approach things in two completely different ways. What I find fascinating about this, Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you in a second, is where this is going to land next. And I think we're going to be turning to Joel Kinnaville, the head coach of the Florida Panthers, who's implicated throughout this investigative report as placing the team's Stanley Cup chase as a priority ahead of, you know, properly reporting this through internal channels and investigating the alleged, you know, activity rather than putting his focus on the Stanley Cup. He doesn't look good in any of this.
Hashtag release the emails, Dan. If the Blackhawks just did it, there's going to be a lot more pressure applied to Washington football team. Congress, as we mentioned, at least on social media, not in the podcast, the date we're looking forward to on the Washington football investigation, November 4th. That's when books, records, including those emails, Congress is asking for. So we'll pay attention to that. One quick what to watch for, then we'll send us home. A big story that broke on Friday. We're not going to cover it on this podcast. We want to get a little bit more information before we delve into it. Potentially a very, very big story coming out of the NBA. Donald Sterling was once pseudo-removed. It wasn't necessarily removed, but had to give up his ownership stake in the Los Angeles Clippers. It's happened with Carolina Panthers. Jerry Richardson, the owner over there, had to lose control of the team. There's a story brewing at ESPN. We'll see if it actually comes out. But there's been word that ESPN is working on a story against Phoenix Suns owner Robert Sarver with alleged racial-based comments, gender-based comments, so much so that that story kind of leaked. A reporter put it out there that the NBA was bracing for it. The Suns issued an emphatic denial. But we'll see what comes of it. It's very rare that owners are forced into this potential situation, but we might be getting there. But again, we'll keep a pin on it.
We're going to have to dive in, I think, on the Blackhawks. It might require a separate show because this investigation ends with the Blackhawks, but now it takes on new tentacles and new tributaries, roads leading to Winnipeg and to the Florida Panthers, who have a league-leading 6-0 record with Joel Kinnaville, who's won Stanley Cups in Chicago and has the top team in the National Hockey League. And Gary Bettman is going to face a very difficult decision here on how to address this situation and how, if at all, to discipline Joel Kinnaville while remaining true to his word that there's going to be zero tolerance with respect to this kind of behavior. So that in and of itself is going to be a separate episode. And that's where my focus going ahead is. And that's what I'm going to be looking for is the next steps in this investigation.
So we'll keep a pin in all the stories. Certainly there's more that we haven't been able to discuss. As always, Dan Wallach is on Twitter and social media at Wallach Legal. Myself, Dan Lust at Sports Law Lust. The show at Con Detrimental and the website, conductdetrimental.com. We want to give a big thanks to everyone that's been leaving all these reviews. We asked for them on the last episode and we got them, shockingly. A couple more five-star reviews helped grow the show tremendously. For Dan and myself, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.